Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For many, this week featured one of those moments where life pauses for a few minutes as we anticipate an outcome, waiting to exhale.
State of Minnesota, County of Hennepin, District Court, 4th Judicial District. State of Minnesota Plaintiff versus Derek Michael Chauvin, Defendant. Verdict. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count one, unintentional second-degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this...
The media duly recorded expressions of joy, relief, a momentary respite from sorrow, loss, and outrage.
Justice has been served, and you can see the reaction from the crowd, how America feels.
The verdict also lifted the sense of impending doom we've all been conditioned by generations of experience to feel each time a jury deliberates.
It's playing out as we see it on the streets of this city. Those people who are peacefully protesting feel that justice has been done.
Funny thing about justice, it can't be extrapolated from one rare episode of accountability. And someone should probably tell Nancy Pelosi that sacrifice is not a silver lining for murder. What we collectively witnessed Wednesday was one man being held accountable for one crime. Justice with a capital J? No. When the enemy is institutionalized racism centuries in the making, victories are small, incremental, and achingly slow. Wednesday's exhale of relief? It was just one moment. Progress, if any, will be measured from outcomes ahead. So while no pundit can know the effect of Derek Chauvin's conviction on society, we do know that the consequences of the movement that erupted last summer are now being felt. Millions of people around the world took to the streets in the name of racial justice. The protests were overwhelmingly peaceful, but there were also major episodes of violence, property damage, and wanton destruction. And so our national vocabulary was tested. What has taken place? Is it First Amendment-protected protest marred by spasms of rage? Or, as the Republican Party insists, are our cities under siege?
You see the response from the national Democrats, Biden, Schumer, and Pelosi, who barely acknowledge the rioting and the looting that's taking place.
So the cities are being burned and looted, businesses crippled, and the left wants police departments decimated.
The burning cities narrative is not new. But if wide public support of Black Lives Matter tells us one thing, actual legislative action offers a grimmer reckoning. Quietly, Republican-controlled legislatures around the country have been introducing bills to criminalize protests, or, as they put it, to stop the rioting. Tammy Abdullah is national correspondent covering criminal justice for USA Today. Tammy, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's begin with the status quo. In all these states where these bills are under consideration, it's already illegal for rioters to injure police and civilians. It's illegal to damage property, illegal to commit arson, illegal to loot retail businesses. What's supposed to be gained by these redundant statutes?
They up the penalties that rioters may face. They bring it up from a misdemeanor to a felony. They bring it from like a citation to a misdemeanor. They also expand what is considered behavior included in that rioting. It adds in things like taunting police or throwing an object or even potentially the intent to throw something, whether or not you've actually hit a person, as part of the rioting statute.
Much of the attention is on Florida. What does the law that Governor DeSantis signed provide?
There are several aspects. One, it expands and really revises the definition of what is considered a riot, making it, you know, a gathering of three or more people who are collectively intending to engage in quote-unquote disorderly conduct and participate in quote-unquote a violent public disturbance that ends in property damage, injury, or, and this is the key part, a danger of either of those things. It's really rather subjective as to what danger of creating injury or property damage might mean. when you talk about a group of three people gathered together on the sidewalk or street. It also adds in tougher penalties for, you know, mob intimidation, quote, inciting a riot, and defacing, damaging, or destroying a monument. That language is specifically geared toward protecting the Confederate statues that are scattered throughout the state.
So if I am in a cluster of three or more people, and someone from that cluster throws a Molotov cocktail or throws a rock at a cop, I am subject to be considered part of this three-person plus conspiracy to commit mayhem?
Yeah, so that is what critics have a real problem with, that it sort of clumps people together and really leaves it up to the officer on the street to determine whether or not you are part of a collective, whether or not you're included in this. And I don't even think it needs to be a Molotov cocktail. It could be a plastic bottle. You throw it at a trash can to the side of the officers and you miss. It's up to them to decide whether or not there was an effort to cause them injury or perhaps cause property damage. So it really can be rather subjective.
There's similar legislation in the hopper in Kentucky, Iowa, Minnesota. Are all these proposed laws using the same kinds of broad language?
There's a lot of it. There are tons of these bills that they want to become laws or have become laws that give drivers, for example, legal protections, civil immunity if they unintentionally hit a protester. In Oklahoma, the language is if you're, quote unquote, fleeing a riot and you unintentionally hit a protester, then you are given legal protection. In other places, the language is a little more broad. That's notable because last summer, there were more than 100 incidents in which people drove their cars into a crowd of demonstrators. Just to like pull back for a second, we're talking about 93 similar bills that have been proposed in 35 states since George Floyd died in Minneapolis. Most of those bills have been introduced in Republican-controlled legislatures, first and foremost. And, you know, they may or may not pass, but the political climate really favors them in places like Arizona, Indiana, Iowa, Missouri, and, of course, Oklahoma, where, you know, we saw it already pass.
Red states, not to put too fine a point on it.
Yes. I mean, there has been legislation introduced in New Jersey and in New York. So, you know, there's that.
Okay, so passing bills and getting them signed into law is one thing. Sanding off the rough edges of the First Amendment, though, is not likely to go unnoticed in courts. It is hard to imagine these laws not facing court challenges at the earliest opportunity, and even with the current state of the Supreme Court, surviving those court challenges. What should we expect?
I believe once we see these laws enacted in more places, and as, you know, the next protests, Black Lives Matter protests, or any other protests out there, once those occur, I think we will see that arrests under these statutes will be challenged. The folks I spoke with indicated that that for certain is the case, but, you know, they can't say for sure since nothing has yet happened. You know, the verdict in the George Floyd case was potentially going to be a way to test these laws and challenge them as well. But given the verdict, we've not yet been able to see how things will work out.
What has historically triggered so much violence has been miscarriages of justice. The Watts riots began because of a traffic stop that ended in police brutality. I scarcely need to discuss George Floyd's case. And as a consequence, most of the civil protest has been dominated by African-American protesters. Certainly not exclusively, but is this a protesting while Black set of laws?
Critics would say possibly yes, because as we all know, there's implicit bias. And because these laws and the bills that are trying to be passed include this vague language, it provides a lot of room for that bias to rise up and show. Now, one thing is notable when you talk about this history of primarily Black communities rising up in response to what they view are problematic actions against their civil rights. That has been a very different case this past year. And it was noted to me by multiple folks I spoke with, civil rights attorneys, sociologists, that last summer was historic for a number of reasons. Not only may it have been the largest protest movement in U.S. history, with 15 to 26 million people showing up and marching, but it was also the largest and most diverse group of protesters. Some communities primarily had white people protesting, which is not apparent in other civil rights protests and criminal justice reform marches as well.
Tammy, thank you so much.
Yeah, well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Tammy Abdullah is a national correspondent covering criminal justice for USA Today.
Coming up, let's get some distance. How about the view from 173 million miles?
This is On the Media.